1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
This is how we do it, Ironside Chatters. How the hell are you from sunny San Diego, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and starting to wonder how long I'm going to say that same old thing? I'm Greg Carlwood, and it is always a joy to talk about cryptids and underground entities and the invading spider beings of the sun-moon matrix, but sometimes you got to bring it back home with political assassinations, well-established black ops projects, secret connections, culture-shaping propaganda, and the things that we're almost taking for granted at this point. Because it's no surprise that most major events in history, politics, and modern times have a stranger subtext that isn't reported on the nightly news, and thanks to the determination of people like today's guest, we can put the fractured pieces together and see the situation beneath the surface. And today, we're back in the saddle with my man Nick Redfern, one of the hardest working reality revealers on this island Earth. We had him here not long ago to talk about his massive conspiracy textbook, Secret History, Conspiracies from Ancient Aliens to the New World Order, and there are so many great stories in the Conspiracy and New World Order sections of the book, but we spent the full 2 hours last time talking about ancient aliens, UFO explanations for biblical stories, the Van Tassel scenario, the manipulation of major events by secretive beings, and the kitchen sink, all kinds of wild stuff involving the ancient past and high strangeness. So much stuff that we didn't even get to these more modern conspiracy sagas, and I'm pumped to have him back to get weird with me once again. How's it going, Nick? Welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on again.
Always a pleasure, man. I definitely love the stuff we talked about last time, but some people really do prefer the meat and potatoes types of stories where the motivations of greed and secrecy and the lust for power are really all you need to believe in, because at those upper levels, it seems to be nearly the sole motivation for doing anything. And what's more surprising isn't why they do what they do, but just how much gets swept under the rug, ignored, how much they get away with, how much is glossed over. I mean, it's really shocking sometimes, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, like a lot of history, whether it's conspiracy-based or not, if we're not taught it, people quickly forget it, or worst-case scenario, don't even know about it in the first place. I think that's unfortunate, and, you know, it says a lot about us as a society, when people are asked to point to a country on the map and they can't identify it, you know.
Right.
You can apply it to any aspect of life. It doesn't have to be conspiracies. It's when history isn't taught or gets forgotten, everything gets swept under the rug. Sometimes deliberately, other times just because everything else just gets swept up with it.
Yep. And even the things we do realize, you know, our memories, our collective memory is so short that it allows them to use the same playbook over and over again, which we do see in several areas.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, the thing is to try and just sort of be aware of what's going on around and take notice, and there's not really much else we can do, you know, other than try and do our little bit.
Right. And that's why we're here, man. We're lucky to have guys like you dragging these stories out to see the light of day. So maybe we should dive into some of this stuff. Being in the conspiracy world, I sometimes do get JFK fatigue, hearing about the same story, the same theories over and over again, when there's so much more out there, like the Lincoln assassination, which you did put in this book. We know so much less about there being any alternative theories to the lone gunman story here. Tell us a little bit about this one. Who else could have been involved?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, President Lincoln was assassinated, well, murdered, assassinated, however you want to look at it, on April the 15th, 1865, by John Wilkes Booth. Now, unlike, you know, the Kennedy assassination, where, you know, we have multiple scenarios for the gunman or the gunmen, et cetera, even within the sort of world of conspiracy theorizing, for the most part at least, people still focus on John Wilkes Booth as being, you know, the person who actually pulled the trigger, so to speak. But in saying that, the conspiracies sort of relate to the issue of who perhaps was John Wilkes Booth connected to, things like that. And one of the theories that's been put forward is the Jesuits, which basically had its origins in 1856 in Urbana, Illinois. And we know that he had certain connections with the Jesuits. Now, to what extent possibly, you know, this comes into play is sort of quite admittedly questionable, because I think whenever we find potential gunmen and people like this attached to sort of groups, societies, and sometimes secret societies, inevitably it sort of provokes sort of a finger pointing that, well, there must have been something going on there as well. And, you know, and sometimes that can be perfectly valid. There's also the issue of the British-based masonry organization being involved as well.
Yes.
And one of the theories as to why the British establishment might have wanted Lincoln gone is because if he was killed, if he was murdered, it potentially had the ability to sort of cut the US in two, north and south. And so, in other words, the power that one would have would be both sides then would be less, you know, there'd be less power. And the theory was that it would allow the UK to influence to a greater and stronger degree, and possibly even allow them to take over the banking system, mm-hmm. And take control there. So you've got wildly different theories as to how John Wilkes may not have just been sort of, you know, a disgruntled assassin, but may have been sort of hands and, you know, players in the background directing things that even today we haven't really uncovered all the facts possibly.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And sometimes the further you go back in history to a story like the assassination of Lincoln, mm-hmm. I think the official story is way more cemented in people's minds as opposed to JFK, where they were more skeptical from the start. Or maybe it's just the mainstream narrative being the loudest won out over time, like we were saying. But you got to question everything when the same shadow powers are in play. And for my money, the lone gunman theory almost never seems to hold any water.
No, and even when there is a lone gunman, I think one of the things that makes people wonder is the fact that you have these strands. You know, as I said, we've got the Jesuit thing and the UK thing being tied to John Wilkes Booth. And then with Lee Harvey Oswald, we've got the fact that, you know, he traveled to Russia and he was linked with the Cubans and Jack Ruby and people like this. It's rarely in a case of political assassination that the alleged assassin doesn't have some sort of weird history.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of people, it's important to remember that you really don't very often find a political assassin who just decided to do this or decided to do that. There's always a bunch of unusual or mysterious characters they've been tied with in the past. And I think, you know, that's a pattern we need to be aware of and to take notice of as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. Average people who are slightly mentally unstable enough to assassinate a president aren't the kind of people who should have these high-level connections. What are they doing messing around with these people? It should be a separate class altogether.
Yeah, you're right, it should. And but when we do see these connections here, there, and just about everywhere, and we see it happening time and again, you know, the pattern is clearly developing. Now, where the pattern leads is the big question and the big answer that we're looking for. But I do think that when we see this sort of repeated, not necessarily a repeated event, but a repeated set of circumstances and the situations concerning the alleged assassin, you know, it's a case of we just got to look into it purely and simply because, in my view, at least, it goes beyond the realms of coincidence to think that we would just keep seeing this pattern time and time again. There's sort of, to me, there's like a motivation behind it, or there's a connection somewhere with more powerful figures pulling the strings.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It's just about finding out who. And I'm realizing that us humans are drawn to neat and tidy conclusions, but I'm still probably in that camp that thinks Lincoln, Garfield, and JFK were all assassinated for their outspoken comments and active resistance to the big banking families. I mean, they did all have that in common, from what I understand, no?
Yeah, I think certainly in the modern era, where people be able to relate to it more, I mean, Kennedy is a classic example because, you know, he was someone who really did want to essentially change America and change the world as he saw it for the better. And that usually means, or did mean, I think, you know, sort of taking the control out of the hands of powerful figures and having a government for the people, the whole issue of funding endless wars, that kind of thing. He was against that. And I think quite possibly what happened was that he was sort of annoying and angering so many different people from different angles that in an almost unique situation, they may have all in some fashion got together. You want him gone, we want him gone, we'll all take a little bit of responsibility, and that'll guarantee no one will ever talk about it, otherwise we'll all go down. And I think that could have happened. Somebody in Cuba wants him gone, somebody in Russia wants him gone, the mafia want him gone.
Right.
Possibly, you know, rogue people in the establishment want him gone as well. And somebody knows someone, somebody knows somebody else, somebody makes a phone call, and before you know it, the job's done. And mm-hmm. there's never, you know, there's not been one specific body that was responsible, but a whole range of them, and they all know the implications of ensuring that they help to keep up each other hidden.
Right.
Otherwise, they all, like I said, they all go down.
Yeah, I mean, when you try to turn the tide on systems that they've set up for generations, I mean, you become an enemy of all the cemented power groups. And yeah, it's not unreasonable to think that they would collude to get rid of somebody. I mean, it makes total sense to me. Another assassination that seems to have a deeper story that you wrote about in this book is Martin Luther King Jr. And I found this part pretty interesting. And the details here aren't quite as widely circulated as a case like JFK, but it does have some parallels to other high-profile assassinations, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, again, Martin Luther King is a classic example of someone who, when you look into his life and his background and the things that were going on and all sorts of weird stories about, you know, him having supposedly this mysterious handler, you know, or controller, if you like, role. Again, we have this situation where it's never black and white that it was just a guy who had a grudge against Martin Luther King and decided to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
There's always other issues going on. Now, I mean, for example, one of the interesting things is this entire issue of this character Raul. The story gets into sort of, as I said, handlers, controllers, even the MK Ultra mind control program, split personalities, all sorts of weird things. And when you actually see that, it almost comes across like a real-life Manchurian Candidate type scenario, with James Earl Ray possibly being cherry-picked, if you like, because he was of sort of like a volatile character to start with, and he was a criminal. But so, in other words, he would have been the perfect fall guy for someone that may have wanted to use someone who, when, you know, background checks were made on them, he turned out to be the, you know, the perfect person. I mean, for example, I mean, he was found guilty of burglary in 1949, served 2 years in prison in 52 for armed robbery, mail fraud, another armed robbery, etc. You know, the list just goes on and on. And but in saying that, someone like that is the ideal person to, as I said, to be the stooge, you know, to be the fall guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do, I mean, even, for example, the Department of Justice, you know, look very deeply into these claims of a secret handler and all these stories about other people pulling the strings and so on. And my view, you know, one of the things I point out, a lot of people point the finger at the government and say, you know, the government's the bad guys and, you know, the CIA did this. The more I've looked into it, I actually think that a lot of these events and a lot of the real sort of people who actually control the planet, it's actually nothing to do with, they're outside of government. You know, they're that powerful. They, you know, ancient families, rich families, secret orders, people who can get things done without anything being noticed and without any oversight because they don't need to ask for oversight. You know, the ones who really, the big power players, and the people they could hire to get things done, et cetera, et cetera. I think very often it's these sort of rogue bodies that are the ones responsible. And we say, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's the FBI, it's the CIA. When I actually think, you know, it could be sort of, or more likely to be sort of shadow agencies, things like this. And I think that could be the case with James Earl Ray,
mm-hmm.
that people may have wanted Martin Luther King gone because they felt, you know, from our perspective, you know, he was a major hero in the United States. You know, he changed the country.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been people, not necessarily in government, but again, certain power players on the world stage, never mind the US stage, on the world stage, who wanted him gone, and somebody had to be found to be the fall guy, like Oswald. And, you know, so that may explain, you know, why the DOJ went looking, couldn't really find anything. And some people say, oh, well, they covered it all up. I actually don't think they did. I think they went looking and were puzzled that they couldn't find anything. But again, I think this says more about these mysterious figures, shadow groups, rogue groups, that kind of thing, that do have the ability to pull something like this off and get away with it.
Yeah, yeah. It goes without saying that the establishment doesn't want a united and inspired populace. And if there's a guy out there doing that, there's a lot of groups that would love to just get rid of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did copy down one quote from James Earl Ray from your book, but apparently he made the statement, "I might have been partially responsible without knowing it." And I mean, obviously that's a guy who's trying to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
at least it strikes me as that. It's a guy who doesn't even really know what happened, it seems.
No, I mean, that's actually sort of a really, I wouldn't say famous statement, but it's actually, and a lot of people don't even know he made it. But even though it's a very short statement, it's quite sort of telling and revealing in the sense that, to me, what it sounds like he's saying is that, okay, I did it, but I may not have been in control of my faculties when I did, not because he would have gone crazy, but because he'd been sort of possibly even rendered into sort of, you know, a hypnotic trigger word type state.
Right.
And in that sort of semi-altered state, he performed the task that he was required to do. And then afterwards, he comes out of it in this kind of dazed situation. And it also suggests to me a little bit that maybe he was putting the word out to someone to let them know that he realized what had been done to him. You see what I mean? He wasn't necessarily telling the media. He was telling the string pullers behind the operation, hey, you know, I know what happened, and I'm releasing here a little bit of like a snippet of information that people might pick up on and realize I'm talking about some sort of mind control type thing.
Right. And you did mention this character, Raul, and that is worth spending a little bit of time on because this is very strange. I guess he met this guy after he got out of prison or escaped from prison. And this really does seem like the textbook type of guy who would show up and manipulate someone who was, you know, kind of had their hands tied with life, because if you escape from prison, you don't have a lot of options or resources. So this seems like a prime target. This guy, Raul, comes in and starts manipulating him. And I mean, that seems to be what happened, right?
Yeah, well, this guy, Raul, it almost comes across like a Man in Black type character.
Yeah.
You know, very sinister, Machiavellian almost, who suddenly pops up in James Earl Ray's life and almost sort of takes control. Ray kind of, you know, follows his every word, and reportedly Rael told him to purchase a rifle, meet with him in Memphis, and, you know, you're going to get this particular boarding house, and you're going to get the job done. And there's also a story that Rael essentially set up James Earl Ray to be sort of a patsy in the same way that Lee Harvey Oswald claimed he was. But if you look at the story of Raul, now whether it's true or not, that's the big question, but it does sound like that he was deliberately inserted into the story to ensure that one way or another James Earl Ray would be perceived as the assassin, and that Raul would be in the right place to get James Earl Ray also in the right place at the right time to ensure that, you know, there was a paper trail showing he bought a rifle. And then Raul vanishes afterwards, which may have been the case with, you know, if Oswald really was a patsy as well, that both of them were set up to be fall guys when they actually thought something else may have been going on.
Yeah, and another thing I had heard is, wasn't there, after the fact with the Martin Luther King Jr. trial, wasn't there a civil case later where the conclusion was that there was some type of conspiracy involvement?
Well, yeah, there was. But, I mean, again, it's one of these things where, you know, very often sort of like a civil suit or, you know, one that isn't sort of, I guess, you know, like an official police investigation or the FBI, it never really sort of catches the attention or, unfortunately, just doesn't always have the credibility in many people's eyes that, oh, well, you know, somebody just came to a different conclusion. I think that's how it's often looked at. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a lot of people are critical, for example, of the Warren Commission report because it was an official government report and everybody knows the conclusions.
Right.
And, you know, whether people believe it or not, they know it. Far less people know, for example, in the 70s when you had the, you know, the Select Committee on Assassinations that actually concluded there was a conspiracy. You know, a lot of people forget that.
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, no, the government's conclusion is the Warren Commission, which technically it is. But equally technically, you know, the 1970s report is just as valid in concluding that there was a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
But in other words, it's kind of like the situation with Martin Luther King, but another conclusion comes along further down the line after a very high-profile conclusion becomes a part of major history. And, you know, the one further down the line just gets swallowed up or just forgotten, you know.
Yeah, I mean, once the event is no longer in the public's eye, the main public's focus, I mean, what difference does it make? Sometimes the truth does come out later, but the history books have already been written. The kids are being taught in school that this is how it was. And the alternative idea is sometimes it's a common perception, but, I mean, it still never gets full validity because it's already been cemented in history.
Yeah, and of course, you know, as I said, the other problem is, even legitimately, unfortunately, people just say, well, they came to a different conclusion, big deal.
Right, right.
You know, we've already got one conclusion, so why should we believe that one? I think a lot of people take that approach as well. So, you know, it's just unfortunate that the speed that events occur and investigations are launched and concluded and it's all wrapped up.
Yeah.
And people move on. It's almost like, well, what else are we going to do but move on, unfortunately.
Yeah. I also find it interesting that there's a disproportionate number of patsies with three names, John Wilkes Booth, Mark David Chapman, James Earl Ray. It's kind of uncommon.
Well, most people have a middle name, but it doesn't get used. But you often find that in cases involving assassins, the media decides to use the middle name. You know, I mean, I've got a middle name, David, but, you know, it never gets used.
Right.
You know. But with assassins, it's almost always used, and it's almost like, you know, that three names rolling off the tongue, Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, Mark David Chapman, you know, the list goes on. It is almost, to me, it seems like it's done so people will remember it,
mm-hmm.
And they'll focus. You know, John Wilkes Booth even, people will focus on it. If you just say John Smith or John, you know, John Booth, it doesn't sound that memorable. It's a John Wilkes Booth or Lee Oswald, but Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, it has more of a, and I don't mean in a good way, you know, it becomes infamous, but in an infamous way, sort of a three name title,
yeah,
does become memorable in history. And I do sometimes wonder if that's the reason for it, that it's designed to keep that person in profile rather than someone else who may have been the culprit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's a little neuro-linguistic programming that we just haven't solved. Speaking of those types of things, you also do dedicate a few pages to MKUltra, and of course I'm sure all the listeners are familiar with the term and that it was the CIA's mind control program in the 50s and 60s, but you've done a lot of research into it. What threads do you find most interesting in the MKUltra saga?
Well, one of the ones that fascinates me, and which I've written about in a couple of books, and which I sort of touch upon here, is the way in which MKUltra and some of its sub-projects may have actually been involved in the UFO subject as well.
Right.
There are a number of intriguing threads in a number of intriguing UFO cases that seem to suggest they may have been deliberately fabricated events, stage-managed to try and present, you know, an alien angle, essentially to not necessarily deliberately always to provoke an alien angle, but something along the lines of, well, if we can convince people they're seeing aliens, we can convince them of anything. Let's experiment on people to the absolute extreme possible, and if we can convince them of this or convince them of that, then the program's clearly good to go. And I think, you know, that's an important thing to remember. A lot of people don't realize, or so just preface this by saying, you know, the famous Betty and Barney Hill case of 1961, the alien abduction story, missing time, etc., etc. Well, John Fuller wrote The Uninterrupted Journey in 1966, which was pretty much, you know, the first full-length book on alien abductions. A lot of people don't realize that John Fuller actually met with some of the MK Ultra guys in the 50s, and at one point there were people who on the inside who wanted him to tell the story of MK Ultra, and he took a deep fascination in MK Ultra for years. And there are theories and rumors that, you know, he may have been brought on board to essentially tell the alien angle of the Hill case, knowing there was something else to it. I mean, I'll give you another example. In the turn of the 1970s, he wrote a book called The Day of St. Anthony's Fire. I don't know if you know that book, but it's about an outbreak in France. It's a non-fiction book, but an outbreak in France of essentially just an outbreak of wild hysteria, just sort of almost like crazed hysteria in this little French village. Mm-hmm. And there's good evidence now that this was some sort of mind control, not so much mind control with chemicals, but possibly some sort of aerosol-based stimulant to affect people's minds. And he wrote an entire book about this. And in more recent years, more and more data has come forward on this little French town, suggesting it really was targeted for things like hallucinogenics and just to, you know, see how it would affect people. And that Fuller should have written about it in 1970 suggests he may well have had some inside data. So I think, I know for me, definitely one of the angles is, although I think there is a genuine unknown UFO phenomenon, I also think that phenomenon may have been used, again, by sort of rogue agencies and things like this to see how far the UFO subject can be used as a cover for other things, and possibly even as a tool one day of manipulation. You know, this whole scenario of creating fake UFO events to essentially frighten the population, you know, like a control factor, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, it could be. And just like MK Ultra having ties to both the CIA and ufology, the same can be said about Disney. Let's talk about this Disney UFO documentary. It seems pretty weird. I mean, now I've heard you can see most of it on YouTube, but I mean, how did this happen?
Well, yeah, this is sort of almost one of those, you know, strange but true kind of things, or the truth is stranger than fiction, that sort of scenario.
Yeah.
We have to sort of go to understand the sort of the full story of the Walt Disney CIA connection. We have to go back to the early 50s when there were major waves of UFO activity all across the nation, in fact, the world. 1952 particularly was a really major year. And we know through Freedom of Information Act documents that the Air Force, the FBI, and the CIA were concerned. And the Air Force, certainly, and the FBI were looking into, you know, UFO reports and collecting them. One of the agents was one of the bodies, I should say, of the CIA that looked into it was called the Robertson Panel. And although the Robertson Panel was UFO themed, it wasn't so much looking at the issue of, you know, what UFOs are, are, where they're from. They were looking at it from their concern that the Russians might try and exploit the UFO phenomenon by planting hundreds and hundreds of fake reports in the US all at once and clogging up the emergency channels and then allowing some sort of sneak attack, or possibly to spread even worse stories and just have the, you know, the US population in a state of hysteria. So they were looking at it from a psychological perspective. And one of the big recommendations that the Robertson panel had, which was actually, as I should stress this, you know, the team itself was some of the most sort of prestigious people in the, you know, the defense world, the scientific community, et cetera, psychologists as well. And one of their recommendations was that the Walt Disney Corporation should be brought on board to make documentaries and cartoons to essentially try and manipulate the US mindset, the population's mindset and attitude towards UFOs. So in other words, it was a case of essentially creating propaganda to sway the public on this in this direction or that direction in terms of the UFO phenomenon. And, you know, in one sense, it gets quite sinister, the idea of sort of little kids watching cool cartoons about UFOs, yet they're subtly being manipulated to believe this or that. And we know that in the 50s that they were certainly approached to make these documentaries. We actually have the Freedom of Information documents officially released that talk about, you know, let's approach the CIA. But there are other stories, one which came from a guy named Ward Kimball, who was one of the big high-ups in the Walt Disney Corporation for years. He talked about how there are other programs where, for example, the Air Force had approached them, again with a view to making UFO documentaries. But this is where it got really intriguing. It was the idea of making documentaries in the event that one day we need to tell people the full story. And Kimball said that, you know, he was told stories about how, if the documentary went ahead, he would be shown film footage of UFOs in flight, that, you know, footage that could not be denied, that kind of thing. Now, whether or not he was being used as a means to sort of emphasize the alien meme, so to speak, or whether that was actually true, we don't know. But certainly Ward Kimball said that, you know, the Disney Corporation was heavily linked to the UFO phenomenon and the intelligence community.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. I love that that documentary is out there now. And I, growing up, I did have a little VHS tape of some World War II propaganda cartoons. I had no idea what I was watching. I didn't find it funny. But now that I've seen those things again, I'm like, yeah, that's complete propaganda about paying your taxes and how the U.S. Empire is the good guy and just all that stuff. And it's like, why are you talking to kids about this? They don't have taxes to pay.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, one of the issues with children is we're, you know, all of us when we're kids, we're sort of quite impressionable.
Right.
And that's an important thing to remember. And, you know, that's why I often sort of worry about, occasionally worry, you know, I don't dwell on it, but I mean, kids today, they really don't have the sort of lives we had growing up. Everything's about staying indoors and you just listen to this and you get your news here.
Right.
But don't go outside and play. My God, you might get killed. You might fall over and cut your knee. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this comes back to what I said about kids being impressionable, that they're brought up today to accept that sort of what in English is called the nanny state, constant, well, don't do this, you know, because that might happen to you, and don't do that because this might happen to you. And if you don't do anything, well, nothing's going to go wrong. And I think, you know, again, that's sort of today's equivalent of placing an impression upon someone to achieve a means and an end. You know?
Right. I mean, when I look at Disney, I sometimes wonder if the social experiment or the social engineering experiment of Disney with their connections to the CIA and propaganda videos and this UFO documentary, I wonder if that's where it ends or not, because it would seem logical that it would extend to other areas of Disney. And there are researchers like Freeman Fly and Jamie Hanshaw who talk about the princess programming of Disney, that girls are taught to be materialistic and have unreal expectations of love. And also, there's not very many Disney movies that have a strong mother. You could say that's social engineering and trying to disrupt the family, because in every Disney movie, it's either an evil stepmother or they kill the mother, but there's very few. I struggle to even name one off the top of my head that has a strong mother character.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, to be honest. But, you know, I mean, this sort of gets to the heart of a lot of conspiracies, for me at least, in the sense that what all this points to is us not seeing the big picture. We're seeing a fragment, or we're seeing an image and we have an interpretation, but we're not seeing the full picture of what's going on behind the scenes and what the motivation is, you know, for what is going on behind the scenes. And I think that's a very important issue as well. And I'm just not sure, you know, how we go about taking things further in some of these cases. I mean, I think it's like a lot of people with the Kennedy assassination, just to quickly jump back to that. People say, yeah, it's the Cubans or it's the Russians or the Mafia or whoever. And very often, like you said, people want it black and white. But it's kind of like with the Disney thing, when you have threads of a story, generally there are more and more threads, but they don't, you know, the more you dig into it, they often go in a lot of other directions.
Right.
Like, for example, the Walt Disney and the CIA. Well, yeah, it was, you know, with the Robertson panel, but then Ward Kimball said it spread further to the Air Force wanting to bring them on board as well. And there are also stories possibly about them having access or being given access at some point to, like, alien autopsy footage, that sort of thing. Now, that sort of begs the question about these stories of alien autopsies. Were they real, or was that going to be, or was that some part of some sort of ruse to sort of try and convince people that aliens are here and it's not some sort of social control tool, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's tough to know, and you are right. There are so many threads. Another one in the Disney thing that I just thought of is all the subliminal messages people say they see. In some of the movies, they're a little bit sketchy, and you're like, oh, I don't really know if that says sex in the clouds in Lion King, or I don't really know if he says take off your clothes in Aladdin. But in some cases, it's very clear. Like in The Rescuers, there is a frame, one single frame where you look in the window and they've got a naked woman there that's not animated. They put a live picture of a naked woman in an animated movie, and they always chalk this up to a disgruntled employee who was mad or a prankster who just wanted to put something in there. Kind of like the lone gunman theory. Oh, it's just this one guy. It's not part of a larger agenda, but there are a lot of Disney movies that include those weird subliminal references to sex.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that.
Oh, yeah. Definitely look that up, because it's pretty interesting how many there really are. And just for the hell of it, I pulled up a list of Disney movies just to see the mother thing, because I find it pretty interesting. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, no mother. Pinocchio, in Dumbo, he's ripped away from his family and abused in the circus. Bambi, they shoot the mother. Cinderella is an evil stepmother. Alice in Wonderland is largely an orphan story. So is Peter Pan. There's no strong parental characters for those people. Aladdin, the Sultan, doesn't really have a wife. It's just him, Jasmine's dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. That's a pretty decent list of them. And The Jungle Book, another orphan story. But it's like, if for a company who everybody's first thought would be, oh, these are great stories for kids, moral tales, they're family oriented. Well, are they really? Because where is the family in a lot of these main movies?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I hadn't really sort of looked at that angle. I mean, I've got to be honest, you know, I focused in the book and the research on the, you know, the tie-ins with the Robertson panel,
yeah,
the CIA, because it was such a strange story. So, you know, I'm not sort of one who, you know, sort of dug into the whole, you know, Disney angle elsewhere. But I mean, but it does get back to, you know, what I was saying, that the more you dig into it, although it's fascinating, the more data we dig up. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it becomes difficult to solve some of these mysteries, because they're so huge in scope and taking so many different people and different strands and agencies and organizations that you end up with your head just spinning, you know, because it's not black and white, and it just, you know, the more questions you get or the more answers you find, it just leads to more questions. You know, you find one answer, but that one answer gives you another five questions.
Right.
Those five questions might give you 10 answers, but provoke another 50 questions.
I hear you, man. And I took us way off the map, but to bring it back to your book here and bring it back to aliens for a minute, you also do write about in here about cattle mutilations quite a bit. And I guess cattle mutilations are something I got the gist of when I was a kid getting involved in UFO stories, but I never really dug too deep. But these are really interesting cases because they did leave behind some physical evidence in a lot of cases, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the reason I talk about this in the book, because I'm sure all you listeners will have heard of cattle mutilations, and, you know, for a few maybe haven't. Predominantly, it sort of began in the 60s, although there are some stories of earlier ones, where cattle, chiefly cattle, but sometimes horses and other animals, were found dead, with organs removed, with skin removed, tongue gone, eyes, sexual organs. And it didn't look like random attacks from predators, you know, like coyotes or wolves or whatever, anything like that, mountain lions. It looked like something essentially intelligent had sliced into them deliberately and carefully to remove certain specific items. And very often, these certain specific items would be typical of, you know, many of the attacks. Like I said, certain organs, the lips, the eyes, the sexual organs, that kind of thing. And very often we have reports of unmarked helicopters in the area, unidentified lights. Now, the reason I included this in the book was one very important reason, that through the Freedom of Information Act, the FBI has released its files on cattle mutilations. They're actually available for free download at the FBI's website, The Vault, which is a really good website for accessing previously classified documents that have been released through the Freedom of Information Act. What makes these cattle mutilation reports really stand out is that many of them are the original New Mexico State Police reports that really prompted the FBI to sit up and take notice. And, I mean, if you look at the police reports, they sound like something straight out of the they sound like real X-Files, and in many respects they are. For example, there's a case from 1976 investigated by police officer Gabe Valdez, where a rancher had found one of his cows missing. And in the area, there were these weird tripod landing marks. Scientists came out, this is all in the files, found that where the tripod marks were found, there were elevated radiation readings. There was a strange sort of chemical liquid found at the site, which upon analysis, nobody could figure out what it was. There are reports of black helicopters flying over us in subsequent nights. And this is just one of dozens of reports. The documents that the FBI have released are probably in the region of about 300 pages now, and I think about 150 are at the site. The other ones are sort of the what's called the Rommel Report, which was a report prepared by Kenneth Rommel, a former FBI agent who put it all down to predators and things like this. But if you read the original raw documents, which are at the vault, it's hard to come away from reading those and not realize that something strange is happening. I'm not saying that there isn't a UFO component, but I mean, if you look at the reports, it kind of sounds more like, again, like a rogue agency, because the FBI clearly were not, you know, they weren't obviously involved. They were trying to figure out what was going on, you know. They weren't part of some conspiracy. They're like, what the hell's going on? You know, is this our jurisdiction? But it sounds like some sort of rogue agency may have been doing some sort of biological warfare or chemical warfare testing or both. Or possibly, and this gets even more disturbing, fearful that some sort of virus had entered the food chain and were randomly targeting cattle around the United States at random to see if there was any evidence of these emerging viruses or not. You know, that would be, I mean, you think how many people in the U.S. eat beef.
Right.
If there were concerns, and possibly still are concerns, about the meat industry, you could understand why there would be possibly some sort of clandestine group set up to periodically go out and at random so that no pattern could be discerned. You know, we'll target a cow in Montana, and then we'll fly over to Nebraska, and then we'll, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know, and do three or four targets in each state and try and figure out, is something going on? I mean, this gets into the air. I don't know if you've read the book by Colm Kelleher, Brains Trust.
No.
Oh, that's a really good book. What it's all about is the massive raise that's occurred in the last few years. Well, not last few years, in the last 20 years in the U.S., massive rise in Alzheimer's. I mean, if you look at the figures from like 1979 to now, it's like a jet fighter going vertical almost. That's literally
right,
what it's like.
Right.
And Colm Kelleher has this intriguing theory that the mad cow disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, when that broke out, he actually suspects that this massive wave of Alzheimer's that is developing and growing almost at an unstoppable rate, he suspects possibly that people are being misdiagnosed and they may be suffering from something along the lines of like a CJD, the human variant of mad cow disease, because
yes,
a lot of the symptoms are extremely similar. Now, I know a lot about this because, unfortunately, my mum died of Alzheimer's. Now, her diagnosis was, you know, she started to get confused. She started to get, you know, where she couldn't work properly. She worked in a at a petrol station. She was like the secretary, and she couldn't do like balance the guy's wages at the end of the week. You know, she got mixed up with that sort of thing, and it progressed and progressed, and she had to go and see an Alzheimer's specialist who asked her the kind of things, you know, what year is it, what date is it, things like that. And it was clear that she had some sort of dementia, and he said, well, it's the classic symptoms of Alzheimer's. But the important thing is, and this is the same in the US, they don't always do like a scientific medical check. It's essentially like a psychological check. Mm-hmm. And then they will come back and, you know, do more checks. And if the symptoms are worsening, that's a sign it's like Alzheimer's. And Kelleher points this out, the fact that how easy it is for the misdiagnosis to occur when you're going on the symptoms. But, I mean, there are other similar conditions. There's like one called Kuru, known as the Shivers, a famous story about a tribe in New Guinea who resorted to cannibalism, and they developed a form of essentially like CJD, and they had the same symptoms. It wasn't Alzheimer's, but it affected them in a very similar fashion. And so, you know, he actually makes a good case in his book that cattle mutilations and the whole UFO angle, you know, that could be the cover story for deep-seated fears that something's got into the food chain and we need to keep monitoring it.
Man, I eat a lot of beef, so that is a little concerning. But, man, there's so many poisons in modern society. It's so hard to isolate any one cause, but it definitely could be. It makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, being originally coming from England, I mean, I remember well when the whole CJD mad cow thing broke out. It was almost like The Walking Dead. You know, they're going to say, there are headlines like Britain infected, you're going to have to be placed under quarantine and all this. And they literally killed pretty much the UK cattle herd, millions of cows, you know, just killed them all. And then it jumped to people, and that's when, you know, the panic started. But up until that point, a lot of English people ate beef, but the number of people who actually got CJD was small, even though, interestingly enough, English figures for Alzheimer's have rocketed as well. So, you know, you could make that argument there too. But a lot of people who ate beef didn't get sick. So I don't think, you know, everybody has to worry, but if there is something along these lines going on, a certain percentage of the population may ultimately become affected by it.
Yeah, man. Dark stuff, especially when the damage is already done. But
well, that's a scary thing, because some of these conditions actually can sort of take years to kick in. I mean, Kuru, the one I mentioned, that takes decades. It's pretty much wiped out now, but you occasionally still hear a story of it. But that, for example, that took decades, and people have wondered if in certain people, mad cow could sort of lie dormant for years and then suddenly kicks in, you know, decades later.
Yeah, I mean, it totally could be. And it is a little suspicious that in the 90s, it was a big thing. I read even a Michael Moore book that focused heavily on mad cow disease, and now nobody talks about it. It's not a thing. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another interesting story in here that I wanted to talk about, and it is funny because, you know, when skeptics say things like, oh, sure, there's always a conspiracy to you guys, there's always an alternative story. Well, you write about the disaster with the Challenger shuttle launch, and everyone knows it blew up in midair, and it's not shocking that something like that would happen at least once due to a freak accident. But here again, there seems to be a deeper story, possibly.
Oh, yeah, and again, the story that I tell in the book actually comes from the FBI's own files. You know, it's not a case of me or some conspiracy theorist saying, oh, you know, it must have been sinister because it exploded. No, this actually comes from the FBI's own files. Actually, in January of next year, January the 28th, it'll be 30 years since Challenger exploded to the day.
Damn.
And so I'm sure there'll be a great deal of coverage in January next year. You know, I won't say it's the anniversary, kind of almost sounds like you're celebrating it, but, you know, it's the 30th year of the event in January.
Yeah.
And essentially, the explosion, the disaster, and the deaths of the astronauts was just put down to a disastrous, tragic event, essentially caused by an explosion of oxygen and hydrogen propellants that's blew up the external tank. And then, of course, you know, the whole thing erupted. It's a little-known story that even in NASA's official report, they actually conclude that probably the astronaut survived in the escape pod and were actually killed from the impact of when they hit the ocean. There's certain suspicions and reasons why to believe that they still were alive. I mean, they may have been unconscious, you know, but they may not have been, but... that's actually in the official report that they suspected that, you know, the astronauts weren't killed when it exploded on takeoff, that, you know, they lived a while longer. But what's interesting is that, again, in the same way that the FBI has uploaded its cattle mutilation file to its website, The Vault, it's also uploaded its file on the investigation into the space shuttle disaster. Now, the reason why the FBI opened an investigation was because a number of people contacted the FBI to say that, hey, when we were watching it live on TV, I thought I saw like a flash of light hit the tank as if something had been fired at it. And there was talk of sort of small guided missiles and laser weaponry and things like this. And so the FBI went out and investigated these cases, and some of them were, you know, very, very strange. For example, one came from a woman. The section of the file concerning this woman actually runs to in somewhere in the region about 35 to 40 pages, many of which are actually still withheld to this day. And they talk about how she was in touch with what she called like higher forces. But it's clear, and there are actually a number of indications as to who she actually is. She's actually talking about essentially getting channeled messages from extraterrestrials. And rather than dismiss her as a kook or anything like that, the FBI investigated her story very closely and thoroughly to where she related how these entities supposedly told her about some sort of group, a hostile group that was going to bring down the shuttle, and names of people involved and things like this. And it was all taken very, very seriously. And there are other cases where, for example, actually right here in Dallas where I am, there was a guy who worked in the video industry, and he believed he'd seen something and got, you know, he got recorded footage, and they came out, and not in a sinister fashion, they came out and said, you know, hey, can we look at your, you know, your tapes, your old VHS tapes, as it was at the time. And he's like, yeah, sure, you know, if it's going to help. And so, in other words, you had a number of FBI offices on the East Coast, West Coast, Dallas, elsewhere, all looking into these theories that, you know, the shuttle was destroyed as some sort of hostile event. And, I mean, some of the theories were really weird and intriguing. And as I said, that's probably why they were taken so seriously as well. But one of the things I find interesting, even to this day, is that, you know, the case, I won't say the files weren't closed, they were closed, but they weren't sort of dismissed as, well, this guy's just crazy or this woman's crazy. You know, it was a case of, please tell us what you think happened, and, you know, we'll do our best to try and figure out what the truth is, you know.
Yeah, and there's definitely several interesting threads, and one that I thought really raised my eyebrow was, apparently there was a guy who called a news station and said it was going to happen 2 days before it actually happened. I mean, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, this is a really weird story. Now, this one, it actually involved a guy who reportedly did have sort of psychological issues, but the fact is he did call, you know, to local newsroom and say, you know, the shuttle is going to explode when it takes off. And, of course, a couple of days later, that's exactly what happened. Now, it turns out he'd made a number of previous calls to news outlets saying the shuttle is going to explode, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, somebody might say, well, if you keep saying that, eventually it's going to happen. But even that sounds too far-fetched to believe, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, the idea that if you say it twice, you know, the shuttle's going to blow up, if you say it twice a year, that you're actually one day going to be right. You know, I mean, such a specific alarming event. Most people, you know, it's not like saying, oh, if I keep saying my next-door neighbor's going to get a, you know, a fender bender or whatever. Well, of course, that sort of thing happens all the time. That's a totally different thing. But this guy, you know, he made specific claims that it was going to explode, you know, not in space, but actually on takeoff. And they, you know, the FBI went out, found him, and it was eventually dropped. They said that, you know, we realized that he'd made these claims before. But if it was a coincidence and he didn't know something on the inside, it was a really eerie coincidence, you know, the sort that just doesn't happen, really.
Right, yeah. I'm with you. It's very odd. And I know a previous show we did, we talked at length about the Marconi deaths at that corporation from the, I guess, from the 70s up to the 90s. And there's definitely plenty of strange ones that make you think there's not a coincidence. You know, there's something more than coincidence going on. But in this book, you also write about an odd string of deaths that are involving scientists in the microbiology field. And these are a little bit more recent, I guess, between 2001 and 2005-ish. Can you tell us about a couple of these?
Well, yeah. I mean, just for people who might be wondering about the Marconi thing, I actually wrote about this in an earlier book I did called Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, about weird deaths in ufology. But this was sort of from the early 80s to the early 90s, for the most part, where a lot of Marconi scientists who were working on spy satellite programs, underwater technology, some of them even working on President Reagan's Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, where the work had been contracted out to the UK. And they died in all sorts of weird circumstances, strange suicides, jumping off bridges, muggings, sudden out-of-the-blue heart attacks, things like this. And that's exactly what happened in the field of microbiology, but in the United States, from 2001 onwards. We had literally dozens of people in the field of microbiology essentially dying, just turning up dead. And for those who don't know, microbiology is basically the study of organisms too small to be seen, like bacteria and viruses. And of course, you know, in today's world, there's a lot of concern about viral outbreaks, you know, the idea of somebody unleashing a biological weapon, that kind of thing. So when these scientists started to literally drop like flies, there were big concerns as to whether or not there was a pattern and if they'd been targeted. And it pretty much all began in November 2001, and a guy named Dr. Benito Kay. And he was actually found dead outside his lab at the Miami Medical School in Florida. And there were stories about a mugger or a group of muggers, but it was sort of never really fully resolved to everybody's satisfaction for sure. Now, 11 days after that, you had the death of a Russian microbiologist who defected to the UK, Dr. Vladimir Pasechnik, and he essentially spilled his guts on the former Soviet Union's biological warfare program to British intelligence, told them just about everything they needed to know. Well, as I said, just 11 days after Dr. K died, Pasechnik died as well. And this was like November the 18th, I think, something like that. Then on the 24th of November, the FBI got concerned about the disappearance of a Harvard biologist, Dr. Don C. Wiley. And he was someone who was heavily involved in researching deadly viruses, and particularly like Ebola, for example. And he later turned up dead as well. His car was actually found on a bridge, or the rented car he had was found on a bridge over the Mississippi River. And his body was later found, you know, he'd fallen or jumped or pushed into the river, and his body was retrieved. Then we had a range of microbiologist deaths from the rest of late 2001 through 2003, all across the world, Australia, Russia, China. It was literally, you know, like they were being taken out one by one. I mean, give you an example. I mentioned Russia. On January 28th, 2002, a microbiologist named Alexei Brushlinsky, who was a member of the Russian Academy of Science, he was supposedly killed in what was called a bandit attack. But he was one of Russia's major microbiologists. Then 2 weeks later, there was a guy Viktor Korshunov, and he was also a noted Russian microbiologist. Hit over the head at the entrance of his home in Moscow, Russia. And it turns out he was the head of the microbiology facility at Russia's State Medical University. Now, this sort of gave rise, although a lot of the mainstream media said, it's just coincidence, you know, it's sort of, if you look for threads, you can find them. But like with the Marconi scientist, it was a series of deaths in such a short, delineated period of time. And so people started to get antsy as to, you know, is it some sort of terrorist group targeting the very people who could help combat a viral outbreak? In other words, if there was somebody wanting to release, you know, deadly pathogens, the best thing they could do would be to kill the people who might be able to find a cure. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So in other words, then the other angle was that they were being killed because they were fearful. People were fearful they might be headhunted, you know, by or kidnapped by terrorists to work for them. So we don't really know. All we know for sure is that just like the Marconi scientists, we had people dying under extremely weird circumstances, like sudden and out of the blue suicides when they weren't showing any signs of feeling depressed or suicidal, of jumping off bridges, of committing suicide by, you know, dying from carbon monoxide by, you know, putting a hose pipe from the exhaust through the car window and, you know, dying. And random strange events that, you know, just seem totally off the wall. And, you know, some people have actually drawn a parallel here with sort of MK Ultra scenarios of people being given, you know, when they took these high pressure jobs on, may have been subjected to sort of MK Ultra trigger wording scenarios, and that, you know, when they finished their work or they got problematic and somebody wanted them gone, you know, you give them the trigger word and they're in that trance-like state and they do what essentially somebody wants them to do, which may be jump off a bridge or commit suicide, you know, in a car, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Man, it's been great talking to you. Secret History, again, I loved it. It is a great book, and it's awesome that we got to talk about such a variety of things over two shows. I mean, it's a lot of material, and we definitely didn't even talk about half of it. So before we go, you want to let the people know where they can keep up with you again and where they could get this book before we call it in?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's called Secret History, published by Visible Ink Press, and you can get it off the shelves in Barnes & Noble or on Amazon. People can reach me at my blog. If you just type in Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, that'll show you the link. People can also reach me at Twitter or just type in Nick Redfern at Facebook, and they can find me there as well.
Boom. Well, good deal. Thanks again. I'm sure we'll talk again before too long, but until that day, take care of yourself out there, man.
You too, Greg. Thanks a lot.
You got it. Rock Me Like a Hurricane, people. Another one bites the dust. I think we definitely got into some interesting territory, Lincoln and MLK Jr., and some of the details around the alternative views of events there, which I think show larger signs of a wider pattern. We touched on MK Ultra, which I've been getting a lot of requests for a full mind control show, and I just so happen to have one right around the corner. But the threads between the CIA and Disney and MK Ultra and the UFO phenomenon, I find that stuff really interesting. I don't know what the hell to think, except a few key players had their hands in a lot of pots back then. It makes me wonder about the whole field of ufology. I mean, are they beings from outer space or the inner Earth? Are these people experiencing the effects of androgynous DMT dumps in the brain? Is the whole thing a psyop? Are UFOs the maintenance crew for our galactic fishbowl? I don't know. I wouldn't really be shocked to discover any of those answers are true at this point. I think you can make a good case for most of them if you're savvy enough. It's good to give a little airtime to cattle mutilations, which again, might be alien or might be man. Nick seems to think it was most likely military experimenting with weaponry or something perhaps research-based, but most likely a down-to-earth explanation. And I don't have any issues with that, except that one of the details in one of the accounts Nick talks about in the book says that one of the farmer's cows had both back legs pulled out of the socket as if something tried to lift it up from its back angles, which is pretty freaky. And then, of course, the crazy string of Marconi deaths, which we discussed last week as a possible link to this sentient black goo. And, of course, we've spoken with Nick about the Marconi deaths in the past. And funny thing, I was listening to Joe Rogan, And he talked about the same string of deaths. And I do love when that happens, when an underground story with deep implications or a subject I consider really fringe, I love it when I see a breadcrumb to craziness just left out in the mainstream for all to see like that. Another time was when Graham Hancock was on Rogan and talked about Gnosticism and the Archons and the idea that Yahweh is a negative archonic entity. I was like, shit, man, that's deep level stuff. And what I know some of you out there might say is the deepest stuff of all, Eric Dubay and the flat earth even got a mention on Rogan the other day. I could not believe I was hearing Eric Dubay's name come out of Joe's mouth. Such a funny series of events. All he said was that some crazy guy on Twitter told him that Eric Dubay had some great material on the flat earth, and Joe said he just replied in all caps, "No, he doesn't." And some people will find that dismissive, but you know, I thought it was a little conspiratorial Easter egg to get to hear that. I mean, probably 5% of the listeners of the show know what the hell he might be talking about. But I do think conspiracy culture is growing. I think it's just becoming a part of internet culture, too. The internet loves to share taboos. I mean, what can you do? But in the Plus Show with Nick today, we talked about other strings of deaths. Doctors, bankers, microbiologists. Strange clusters, people. We talked about the anthrax attacks the week of 9/11 and the evidence that that was a lesser talked about false flag that fateful week in September 2001. We talked about Jack the Ripper and the theories behind that saga, depopulation, tracking devices, and all kinds of good stuff. You know the drill if you're interested. $5 a month, 5 shows a month, 95% of the time. Because I know I was supposed to have another show out before the end of this month, but I got on the call and the guest just didn't have a good enough microphone or a quiet enough environment. And so we had to push it back a week. I am sorry. I was disappointed too. But I think it's just better to do it right than worry about what side of September 31st it's on. 9 times out of 10, I record interviews 2 or even 3 ahead to be safe and know how I'm going to roll them out. But I got a little jammed up and then didn't want to sacrifice the quality. I know it happens sometimes. I know in the past 10 shows, I've probably had 6 that weren't ideal. I'm trying to spend more time up front communicating with the guests what will cut it and what won't. And sometimes with some guests, it is a record it while they're on their neighbor's cell phone or you don't get it type of deal. And those are decisions I guess I have to make. But this one wasn't going to be good enough. We're doing it next week. Of course, there will be 6 shows in September now. I have several already booked, and I'm pretty psyched. I'm catching up. There are a couple of powerhouses in there if the universe keeps smiling on me. September is supposed to be a crazy month, according to so many people, economically, in relation to CERN, in relation to Jade Helm. Who knows? Conspiracy people always seem to think something big is coming. But I'm taking notice, that's for sure. I guess that's it for me today. I will pick a money bomb winner on the 31st. Watch your inboxes. Keep your pimp hands strong and your pentagrams tight. Your move, assassination architects, mind control masters, and propaganda programmers. Your frickin' move.
I got a new life. You would hardly recognize me. I'm so glad. Now I'm amazing. I don't care about you. Why do I bother when you're not in the club with me?